Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we are about to launch into our conversation about the City Council, about the City of Baltimore, and the budget that was just passed. We are joined in studio by Councilwoman Belinda Conway, who represents District 7 here in Baltimore City. Belinda, good to see you.
Thank you. Good evening.
And Councilman Carl Stokes is with us once again, of course, councilperson for District 12, joining us by phone. He's at a school event. Carl, good to have you with us.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Councilwoman.
Hi. Good evening, Councilman Stokes.
How are you?
And we will be joined by Jack Young in a little bit and by Ricky Spector, of course, councilwoman from District 5. And also in the studio is James MacArthur, who is reporter for Investigative Voice.
And thank you, Mark.
Good to see you back in the studio again.
Good to be back here. Thank you.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. So the question is, I want to talk to have our listeners talk about, especially those of you who live in the city, what you think of where we ended up. That your income taxes are now going to be the highest in the state, and what you think about that, and did you even know about that? I think our friend and colleague, economist Aniban Basu, who I will make a disclaimer right now to say that Aniban is on the board of directors of the Center for Emerging Media, which is the company that we have that produces the show. So, just that disclaimer should be out there.
Full disclosure.
Full disclosure. I believe in that completely. But Aniban said in the paper this morning that that this was a stealth bill. No one knew it was coming, and it flew under the radar screen. And all of a sudden,
well, Mark,
we are now at the very top.
You saw me shaking my head. I had to step away from the reporter hat for a moment and just be a citizen here. You said highest income tax.
City income tax.
City income tax.
Municipality income tax.
Because we're already in the highest property tax.
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that.
And automobile insurance. Don't forget about that.
Oh, my God, yeah.
We have all that. So, Carl and Belinda, let's start with you. Tell me what happened here. I mean, this is one of the things that Jay Hancock said, and I'll say this again when the other council people arrive, wrote that in his blog that the public choice theory teaches that democracy is often tilted to respond to the interests of the few at the expense of the many. The bottle tax would have benefited Baltimore as a whole, but in a diffuse way. Its effect on any one household in terms of saving jobs, police, etc., would have been hard to measure. So for the majority of Baltimore residents, there wasn't much incentive to strongly support the bottle tax or oppose it, but the incentive came from the industry, the beverage sellers, who lobbied very heavily and had heavyweight Bruce Beriano, who usually spends his time in the hallways of Annapolis, not in Baltimore City, lobbying for this, and the bill was killed. So, Carl, you voted against this bill.
Well, I didn't. I voted against a bunch of other bills, frankly, but not this. Because look, the bottle tax, Baltimore City citizens were taken this year, and they were taken hard by the mayor and the city council. Let me just say that for the record. You know what? We raised four regressive taxes on the citizens of the city. They raised the income tax. They raised the BG&E tax. We raised the energy, the telephone tax, and we took away the discount for people who pay property taxes on time. The bottle tax should have been the first tax passed, but instead, the council did not stand up for the average citizen in Baltimore City. They got raped. I shouldn't use that term today.
No.
I take that back. I apologize.
It's all right.
Given what we're in. But I tell you that all of those taxes I did vote against, and I'm not the only one who voted against them, but those are the taxes that we should have had a debate about. Those are the taxes that we should have said no to, because now the bottle tax, which is a use tax, which is something that, you know, people can decide, do I want it or I don't want it? And Belinda, Councilwoman Conway, did vote against that tax. And I just say that in terms of it all, the taxes that were most regressive are the taxes that passed, 13-2 in the city council.
And I misspoke, Carl. I should have said you voted for that tax.
Yes, I did.
And I said you voted against it, so I apologize for doing that.
Yeah.
Belinda?
Yes, on the taxes was a sore issue. When they first put energy tax and telecommunications tax on the table, I said, if you add one penny to people's BG&E bill, they're going to scream. They're going to scream. They'll be jumping up and down because BG&E bills are astronomical already. We did not get an outcry from citizens about BG&E. There was no outcry about telecommunications tax. We really didn't hear much from citizens except for the bottle tax, some pro, some con. So really, I mean, even when we had taxpayers night,
no one showed up.
I look to hear from the people that I represent, and I consider what they say and how to best represent them. But it's very difficult to gauge that when people are silent. And I quite honestly, I was absolutely floored that there was not a public outcry about the increase in energy tax specifically.
Well, Councilwoman, I think it's very interesting that you said there was a lack of outcry. It seems to me, just from a casual observation standpoint, the bottle tax was very polarized, it was very controversial, and that became a huge distraction. People missed the 29 other increases across the board. One that really, you know, chaps my hide is this parking tax that's going up. It just went up 2 years ago to pay for this circulator that fleeing felons are escaping on. One of my friends just texted me, said, I just saw the circulator downtown rush hour. There's two people on board. We're already paying for that, and now the tax is going up another 20% on the parking. You know, these type of things are just it's questionable as to, you know, have we really cut to the bone, like someone was quoted saying?
Well, let me ask some questions. Okay, Carl, you're going to say something that I'm going
to
open the phone.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, I think the city is pretty much cut to the bone. Let me say that. Over the last few years, we have cut down. I know we always talk about fat in city government, but, you know, right now that we are furloughing for the second year in a row all of the city employees. That's a big deal. They're taking a pay cut for the second year. And I think if you start going department by department, over the last few years, I got to tell you that the previous administrations, I think, have done a pretty good job of cutting the fat out of the bone. Now I think that as citizens, we don't need more taxes, but I think as citizens, we've got to sacrifice. We've got to say some of the services we're getting are essential, and others aren't essential. They're just nice things. Cleaning the street twice a week is not essential when we can come out with a broom and dustpan ourselves and clean in front of our own homes if we don't have to raise more taxes. So I do want to throw that in.
Now, well, you were shaking your head no, Belinda?
I don't think that the city has cut back as far as it can.
Where would you cut?
Well, first of all, I would have taken more money from the rainy day fund. That's one of the things that I fought for. I lost, but I did fight for it because it would have put more money into the budget this fiscal year for fiscal year 2011, which would have increased the amount of trees that we were able to trim and also graffiti removal and alley cleaning, which are things that people wanted. These are things that people need and that people want. And we could have done that for the next fiscal year. I also would have looked at any new positions that have been created in Baltimore City. You know, sometimes when you look at the budget, it's like a shell game. You know, they talk about how many positions they have, how many are going to be cut, but those are positions. It doesn't say where are the top positions. Okay, I've decreased four positions, so I've laid off four secretaries, but I've added one executive position that could have paid for those four secretaries. So, you know, I don't believe that we've cut back as much as we can. I don't believe it. Councilman Kraft offered some cuts in budgets. Most of them I supported, but they failed to come out of committee.
Let me get a caller in here, then we'll come right back. 410-319-8888 is the number here to talk with our council representatives, and we also have James McCarthy in the studio from Investigative Voice. We're joined in studio by Belinda Conway and Carl Stokes on the phone, two of our council representatives. Later we'll be talking as well with Ricky Spector and Jack Young. 410-319-8888. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi,
Susan.
Mark. And Councilperson Stokes and Conway.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity to join you on the air. I just wanted to say that the Baltimore Education Coalition supported the passage of the bottle tax, and we thank the City Council for taking the initiative and getting it done, even at the compromised rate. I do want to say that one of the reasons that we supported the bottle tax is that we were very interested in seeing school-based health centers fully funded and maintained at their current levels, and I'm not really clear about whether or not that actually happened. And so I would be interested in knowing more about whether the health centers were restored in the budget. Thank you.
Yeah, all the health cuts were restored, and all of the school-based clinics will be capped as they were in the previous year. And there was a cut in some of the top administrators in those school health-based clinics, but those were restored when the bottle tax did pass. So all of the clinics are still going to be at the same levels as they were the previous year.
I have some questions, though. I mean, one of the things that really, when we look at what happened and what didn't happen, there's some things that were never on the table. I'll bring up in a little while, but let's take this bottle tax. I mean, why was it so difficult to pass the bottle tax? Who really? I mean, the majority of citizens in Baltimore didn't care whether they're going to think we're going to pay an extra few cents for a Coca-Cola or a Pepsi-Cola or whatever it is people want to drink or. You know, I mean, and it wasn't going to be on water, and it wasn't going to be on juice, and it wasn't going to be on milk, which are more essentials than sodas. Well, I mean, the question is, I want you, to, Carl, let me start with you. I mean, okay. and Linda, I'd like you both to chime in. It seems to me, and I know, Jim, as you come in too, that what Jay Hancock was saying was right, that lobbyists have a lot of power. Arms get twisted. Things can happen. And the people's voice doesn't seem to get heard. So why couldn't we pass this bottle tax?
Well, as you said, I mean, everybody's right on this, that the lobbyists have more money to advertise and to make their voices louder than others. And so, you know, we're not kidding each other here. It's not that they gave favors or they bought anything. Twisting arms is a good phrase, Mark, and that did happen. They showed up every day. They called. They generated, I don't know, hundreds of emails to all of our offices. And so it became a louder voice. And when things begin to happen that way in a political environment, people do start to sometimes wet their finger and stick it up in the air and sort of catch which way it's going. And that's not necessarily a bad thing to have that strong debate. But what you know, Blinda and I both are saying is that the average voice of the resident did not have the advertising dollars, and they did not organize themselves to come up and say we need this. Even we just heard from a young woman who talked about the health clinics. Now they did organize themselves, and in their organizing, they talked about needing money for the health clinics. So it became something that at the end. Became a rallying cry for some to pass the bottle tax. At the end of the day, when we still did not have a health clinic coverage, they were able to say, well, look, guys, you have to pass the bottle tax because there's not enough money to cover our clinics. And so then you heard from the citizen against the bottle tax. In the last 3 or 4 weeks is when we heard from citizens saying pass the bottle tax, frankly, and the workers and jobs.
And also, let me add, we also had Maryland Legal Aid
sure.
that was slated to receive no funding from Baltimore City,
mm-hmm.
none, zero. They provide over $10 million worth of services to Baltimore City residents each year. So I thought that was a worthy program, and there were others rallying for University of Maryland Cooperative Extension program was something else. So, you know, there was a lot on the table to lose. You know, there was a lot at stake, and there was a lot of going back and forth and, you know, trying to negotiate and trying to get deliverables for the community.
You're going to say something, James?
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to stay on topic because I have a number of points I can go with, but it'll stray us from this. You mentioned furloughs. You know, there's city employees are being furloughed across the board. And
yeah.
The first reaction I had, tongue in cheek, is are the take home cars being furloughed too? Because, you know, we've reported on this issue, and you talk about cut to the bone, but we have a lot more take home cars than comparable municipalities that we've checked out on.
Well, I don't know that.
Just for one example.
I don't know, Jay. I don't know. And sometimes, just like city police pensions, are perks of. And you know, again, we're being very honest and frank. Sometimes we give more perks because we can't give as much in salaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you talk about some of the perks, you may say you're doing more than Baltimore County or Howard County, But the truth is that police officers in a Baltimore-Howard County, after 10 years, are making $30,000 more in pay than Baltimore City Police or fire officers. And so you do see the city giving more perks at times because they can't give more upfront money. And I think when you put them all together, you may find a comparable that still weighs in more on the side of the surrounding jurisdictions.
We're also giving more in lawsuits. And it's going to continue to be a problem if the police department keeps high-ranking officials that have sustained, multiple sustained EEOC complaints and one federal pending EEOC complaint. That's a problem.
I'm glad you I was going to hold back on that. But, you know, we had some big high-profile stories in the news. The obvious one is the unreported rapes. But really what's going to come out of that, I think we can safely say, is a lot of people – who were victims, who felt that they were ignored, there's going to be more lawsuits coming out of that. The week before, we saw the settlement of the ACLU NAACP lawsuit.
Yes.
That's only for like a handful of people. Mm. We know for a fact that there were thousands, hundreds of thousands of people arrested who have a legitimate claim. There are other lawsuits pending now. And yes, we need to pay police officers, but it also seems like there's situations on this department that are ongoing that they're going to bleed the city dry just in paying out settlements alone. And what bothers me the most on this is, from a council standpoint, are we being proactive in making sure that this this discipline board that's in internal affairs, when the problems pop up, a lot of these officers seem like they're just getting recycled back in the system and they're sticking around until they end up costing the taxpayers money. I mean, we have several examples, not including the most high-profile example that just happened recently.
Absolutely. It's a problem that has to be addressed. We can call for hearings at the city council. And what I always find to be interesting is that we can have top ranking officials from the police department sitting in council chambers, providing answers to questions in a televised hearing. And then I have officers sending me text messages telling me that what I'm being told is not the truth, and saying you need to ask this. So, you know, it's very difficult for the council to even get good information a lot of times. And the only way that you really find out what's going on is if somebody on the inside trusts you enough to share information with you to make sure that you have the right questions to ask. Because, I mean, there's a problem. There's a problem in the police department. People don't want to lose their jobs, and people are fearful of other types of retaliations that come against them when they speak out, such as the retaliation that I got when I asked the tough questions.
What retaliation was that?
Well, you know, they sent the questions that I asked to the media, and they criticized them, saying that they had nothing to do with the budget.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Which wasn't true.
Oh, was this had to do with racial discrimination inside the police department? Those questions
absolutely
were asking during the budget
absolutely
process.
And top-ranking officers that have multiple sustained EEOC complaints against them.
Your argument being that even though it was more than racial discrimination, this is all affecting the bottom line because it's costing the city money in these lawsuits. Well,
unbudgeted dollars.
We just paid out $5 million on the Sergeant Hobson case, you know, and that's what's paid out. That doesn't count how much legal expenses were spent fighting this thing for 2-3 years. Or actually, it was more than that before the settlement did come down. And again, I mean, we've done some calculations. I don't have them in front of me. But the city is literally paying out millions and millions of dollars in police wrongdoing-related suits, including to officers on the force.
Right.
That's true. And Belinda was on top of that, asking those questions, and got pushback. And not to pass the buck, but the truth is, even in this gubernatorial election, that a lot of these actions of our police department were ordered by the executive branch of government. And we can say it out loud. We should say it out loud. We know what was going on. We know what's going on with these arrests. We know what's going on with this discrimination. We know about the zero tolerance policy. And we know that it was ordered that police just sweep up young black males for no good reason other than they were young black males. We know it. We just should say it out loud. And it was being said at that time, and people get crazy about zero tolerance and fear of young black males, regardless of what their actions are on the street.
These are kind of the bottom line questions of the budget that we never talk about. That's associated
absolutely
with budget.
Absolutely.
Money's money.
410-319-8888 as we talk about the city budget, what happened with that. We'll raise some other issues here in just a moment. Let's go to the phones at 410-319-8888. James MacArthur from Investigative Voices in the studio, along with Belinda Conway, who represents District 7, Carl Stokes, District 12, and Alan, you're on the air.
I think a lot of reasons why, and I didn't care one way or another about the bottle tax, but I think a lot of people were angry and for good reason, because basically for all these years, or anytime anybody calls City Hall, I know for myself, anytime I call, it's amazing how much time my alleged elected representatives aren't in the office and how slow they are in returning calls. They're never there on opening day. They're never there the day before a holiday. You call them. I've not called City Hall and Mayor with the new mayors in there, but Mayor Shields' outreach people were never in there. And it seems like there's, you know, you squander money on this, squander money on that. There's going to be this big race, automobile race in Baltimore. And so as a result, they've been repaving and paving over and over again downtown like that's supposed to mean something. Anything for glitz and glitter is done. And at the same time, a lot of people with legitimate complaints will call City Hall and get be put on hold and be told that our calls are very important. If they're that important, why don't you answer the phone in a timely manner? Thank you.
Well, could I respond to that? I certainly hope that you're not referring to Belinda Conaway's office, because it is my policy and has been since I've been in office. If you call my office and say, I want Belinda to call me back, I call you back. Because I believe in treating people the same way that I want to be treated. And if I call my elected official and ask that they call me back, my expectation is that I will get a call back. And that calls happen, and I always check in on my calls in the morning and in the afternoon to see if I need to make a call back. I don't have a problem calling people back.
Well, you know, in these elections come up, I wonder how city council members respond if they say that I'm not going to keep beating the bottle tax. My last question to the other council people come on about the bottle tax, because I have some other questions I want to raise. But if they say we can say no to the bottle tax, but we're going to raise our city income tax, municipal tax, from 3.05% to 3.2%, if I have that right, yeah. which is the highest in the state.
Mm-hmm.
How do we justify that?
Well, when it was presented to me, what I was told was that it's a tax that you can apply when you get your income taxes, you can get that back. So it's almost like a delay, like you pay now, but you can get it back when you do your tax return, which was the way that it was explained to me. And also, let's start off talking about if we did not find a way to raise new revenue, for example, in the Department of Public Works. When we started off with budget talks, they reported that they would have to lay off over 300 people just for that agency. So having to raise revenue was a real issue. I mean, people talk about the bottle tax. The bottle tax was just a drop in the bucket in comparison to what would have happened if we had not come up with new revenue.
I'll tell you what scares me the most about all of this. This is just for this year. We haven't gotten to next year. And what scares me is that all of this is dependent on people to pay these taxes, but we're not making the city a very attractive place to live. We've been experiencing a drain in population for the last several decades, and having taxes that are going to be higher than anywhere else. We already have 80% of your cops don't live here. I don't know what that tells you, but it tells you something. They don't even want to live here.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the folks who are here are going to suffer with this, and we're going to have less and less paying more and more is what it seems like just from a layman's viewpoint here.
Yeah, you know, the only way – and we're going to have this discussion among the council in the next few months. The only way to grow the wealth of the city is to substantially reduce the taxes. People can't get their hands around that, their thoughts around that. But you can. It's an inverse. It's economics 101. You drop significantly taking people's money from them and allow them to keep it, they will spend it more. It's their stimulus. If you had given everybody in America $250,000 instead of giving billions to the banks who kept the money in their pockets, you would have the economy back where it is right now, because the people wouldn't have banked the money. They would have spent the money. And so if you keep raising taxes on the citizens of the city, first of all, there's less that they're going to spend at the barbershop, at the retail store. There are less people who are going to decide to come into Baltimore City and buy property. And so you reduce the ability to be wealthier, and the reverse happens. You drop the tax significantly. People invest more in the city. They begin to take the vacant properties and to renovate them and to build them and to live in them or to sell them. And people decide to move into the city, and others decide not to move out of the city. You have to begin to show people that you're going to be competitive in terms of your tax rates in order to grow the wealth in the city. We're missing getting 50, 70, 100,000 more people into the city by continuing to raise the taxes among those who are left in the city.
Now, I wonder if anybody in the council, and we'll take a break here and come back and talk about this and go to the phones, Fran and Dan, the next two callers up. Has anyone considered the pilot program, payments in lieu of taxes?
Right.
And the fact that, let's say, like John Padorakis, he's representing a tax loss to the city of $35 million.
Mm-hmm.
And others who have claimed they're going to bring jobs to the city. I think it was in T. Rowe Price was going to bring jobs to the city. Now the jobs are leaving the city, are laying people off right and left. Does that mean that they should lose their pilot and those millions of dollars should come back to Baltimore City? I mean, we're talking about raising our taxes, the working people of the city, but
we got these major institutions
that are just walking away. So I'd like you all to comment about that when we come back at 410-319-8888. Councilman Carl Soakes, Councilwoman Belinda Conaway, and James MacArthur, intrepid reporter for the Investigated Voice. 410-319-8888. Fran and Dan, you're the next two callers up. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite writers look behind the gritty facade of some of the city's tougher neighborhoods. What they find may surprise you. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations and online at www.urbanitebaltimore.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org. Or the number for information is 1-800-888-8823. We are joined in studio by Councilwoman Belinda Conaway from the 7th District and on the phone by Councilman Carl Soakes from District 12 and James MacArthur, reporter for the Investigative Voice. And I'm Mark Steiner here at 410-319-8888. And before I jump into my question I asked earlier about pilots, let's go to the phones and get your questions in here. And Fran in Cockeysville, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I'd like to get your input and comments on this. I'm hearing all of your frustrations, which we all have with our city halls and expecting them to be there for us when we need aid. And my question to you is this, and I'm all for the community helping itself, but do we really need to become our own detectives and really aid and help ourselves when there doesn't seem to be anything there? I've had to do that with drug trafficking in my area, and I've banded together with people in my community to get these people out of the community. It's been very frustrating for us because many times we've called the police, some of them even times with our dispatchers, that they want us to say, well, if one girl actually said, well, if nobody's there, hurt there, then we don't need to come, which really shocked me. But we kept pursuing it, and we finally got the people out. So that's my question and your input, please, is do we really need to be our own detectives to help ourselves?
Yes. Absolutely. In the neighborhoods, we need as much help as we can get. In Baltimore City, our 311 and 911 system, they're data-driven. So when you have people that call and complain and provide information, it's the way that it's set up is that it's supposed to bring more attention to the areas. If people get frustrated and throw their hands up and say, that's it, I'm finished, it doesn't help the situation because it makes it look like there's not much crime going on. We dealt with this in my neighborhood where we had a park that had become infested with drugs. And everything that happened, I called to make sure that those numbers went up in our neighborhood for the 911 calls in reference to drug-related activity to get those people out of the park and out of our neighborhood. We have to be aggressive with it, and I understand that some areas are more challenged than others, but in those areas, it just means that we need more people that are calling and giving all the information they can about these people that are wreaking havoc on our neighborhoods.
But, you know, it doesn't help, though, that 311 has the hours dramatically scaled back now. That was slipped in on the citizens, that 311 is not 24 hours. And there's a lot of times people don't want to really call the police. It's a lesser problem. But they want to call somebody, and they can't call anyone because there's no 311, and it's not a 911
emergency. You can put it in online. It's online 24 hours a day.
Some of the people don't have, a lot of people in Baltimore.
But a lot of people do have access to it, and it is available online. And it's also a good tool because you get to find out what the offenses are. So, for example, you have a neighbor where maybe drugs are being sold out the house, and you go and look online for the complaints, and you find out, oh, I can complain about the high grass. Oh, I can complain about the feces in the yard that they don't clean up. So it also gives citizens an opportunity to see everything that they can call and complain about.
But I think what James was saying, though, that there are a lot of people in the city that are not wired in. There are people who do not have any internet access whatsoever. In the inner cities of our neighborhoods, of our community, the majority of people don't have.
We have one of the highest rates in the country of people on that side of the digital divide, to borrow a phrase, you know.
Dan in Pigtown, you're on the air.
I wanted the reporter from the investigative voice. Now, I read your article right before I left work and agree with a lot of it. And I think that the policies that the city are adopting are driving people out. And I'm in a very unique situation. I actually live in Baltimore County, but I'm the president of a Baltimore City Community Association.
How'd you get that?
Wow, how'd that happen?
Well, I bought some rental properties, and me and some other developers got together, and we started the Washington Village Development Association. And you can go on YouTube, search WVDA, and see all the things that we do. And we've been on Channel 2 News, Fox 45. It's amazing that our sustained cleaning efforts down there that we've been doing now for more than 4 years is actually newsworthy. That's how bad things are in the city. And I got to be honest with you. People tell me all the time, do so much for the community of Pigtown. Why don't you move down here? And there's no way I would ever live in Baltimore City.
Wow.
Being the president of that community association, it's like a full-time job just trying to fight the drug dealers to get them off the streets. And we do everything that you talked about. We have a database that we keep track of all the 311 calls we make, all the 911 calls we make. We have a very close working relationship with the Southern District Police Department. Cannot say enough good things about those guys, but the problem is we work with them, we get these drug dealers arrested, and they go to court, and they get no props, and they just get sent right back out on the street. And they're running criminal enterprises, and it's like, how can we turn the community around? How can we interest the middle class in coming in to Baltimore City when the city can't control the crime? I mean, guys with records that are a mile long.
All right, well, Carl, let me ask you to join in this conversation, and I'll let you jump in as well, James. Go ahead.
Well, I hear his frustration, although he sounds like he's done a great job, but he sounds like so many other people who earn their money from Baltimore City but can't live here. And he goes
most of them work for the city.
Right, and then so he goes out. He earns his money in the city. He has property, rental property, but he lives somewhere else. And I know that's sort of a shot at him, an unfair shot, because he's working hard. But, you know, it is a struggle for so many of us. But we keep passing the blame around. I just think that we've got to figure this out in terms of our policing, which does a good job. And then they go to court and they say the state's attorney or the prosecutors let people go and they come right back out. We're having a debate among ourselves as a society. You know, we talk about the nonviolence of drugs and should we be locking up drug users, but frankly, I think drug pushers should be locked up, and they should be locked up for a long time. So that's different than the users, but I think the pushers are people that we have to take off our street, and I don't think that we've decided as a society what we're going to do about that. And so that's my sort of frustration. If I sound it, it's because I am.
If I can just add, in talking about the punitive measures, we also have to do more to work with people to make sure that they are employable. Everybody out on a corner is not out there because they, you know, they choose to do so. Some of our young people, many of our young people, do not have the skills to be employable. In my district, we have Center for Urban Families. They are on Monroe Street, and they work with young people on the street. They go out and recruit them. They have a three-week program that helps to make them employable, with the goal being that, they will be able to get a job and retain it for at least 2 years or more. They have a very good success rate and a program that works. It's not just Baltimore City. It's, I believe it's a program out of Harlem. But the skills that they teach young people, and they're a range of ages, but they focus on men, our men in the community. The skills that they teach are ones that we would expect people to have, but many of our young people don't. Making it to a job before you're supposed to be there, how to dress for a job, the correct attitude to have, how to complete an application, giving them access to the internet because most jobs now require you to apply online. So while we're looking at punitive measures, we also have to look at programs that lift people up and get them to the point where they need to be, because everyone does not desire to be out on the corner. Everybody is not looking to go to jail. Some of these people need help and don't know where to go to get it.
And it really is a difficult, you know, James, you can come in. This is a difficult question, because when you talk about this, and Edward in the East Side, we're going to come to your call next, but and we're drifting away from the budget a little bit, but in a way we're not.
It's all related.
It's all related. I mean, the issue is that you're not going to lock our way up out of this problem. Every little guy on the corner, I mean, look, if you live in a neighborhood and the corner is full of young guys, older citizens especially, and younger people are threatened by that. It's a threatening thing to see a bunch of guys in the corner.
Absolutely.
Because you know what's going to happen to you when you try to turn the corner, go to the store where they're hanging out in front. Nobody knows what's going to happen. So we have to deal with that.
Right.
But is the way we deal with it by filling up Jessup and the state penitentiary and jails in Cumberland, is that the answer to the problem? Clearly it's not.
Oh.
I mean, where America locks up, America has 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of the prisoners on the planet Earth are in this country.
And in America, Baltimore leads the way. I hate to say it, but we do.
We're one of them.
You know, and if I could just call it, Dan, I appreciate you reading the article. You know, it's always nice to hear from readers. I mean, he really underscores what the issue is as it relates to the budget. If we have people that are earning money here but taking it elsewhere, you're not getting what you could be getting from them.
Right.
And eventually, some of the Dans will get frustrated, and he will sell his property eventually if it becomes just too much of a hassle. And chances are it won't be reoccupied. It'll join the ranks of all the vacant property, so you're not getting property tax from that. And we see more revenue drain. Dan is no longer here. His property's not here. It's vacant. They're not getting the taxes. And I think that is really the reality of what's been happening for years.
We have a lot of people calling in. Let me get to the phones here. And I do want to ask you, before we get to Edward and David, the next two callers up, why is it that the issue of pilots, I raised before we went to break, is not debated in the city council? We're not raising those issues.
We need to get them to pay for the educating the kids.
And the efficacy. One of the things that happened last hour was, even though she didn't want to say it, she was almost admitting, the woman from the city, that private industry is not stepping up to hire the kids in the city in the summer, giving
right.
them jobs, let alone giving their parents jobs. But I mean, but we really need the work. But so the idea, Carl Stokes, I'm going to start with you,
yeah.
about why we're not debating the efficacy of these pilots, how much the city is losing this, and how much are we really getting back?
Well, the two things we should be doing differently about the pilots, everyone. One is that we should be forcing anyone who takes city money to hire city employees, city residents. Let me say that. And people are afraid to say that. In Chicago, it doesn't happen that way. You say what you want about the politics. In Washington, D.C., it doesn't happen that way. In Atlanta, with African-American mayors, it doesn't happen that way. So when a Walmart or Lake Mason or anybody says, we want city money, the city gives them money, they hire construction workers from the city. In Baltimore, people come from Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Delaware, everyone but Baltimore citizens are working at these projects. So you don't have to take my word for it. Go downtown where they have cranes and look at the car license plates and see where people are working. They're not from Baltimore. And she would stop giving people money who don't hire city citizens. We get ready to build a Walmart on 25th Street. Everybody, every worker should be a Baltimore City resident. They should be setting up right now as we speak training, preparing people for construction jobs and other jobs. Every worker should be a city resident, or we shouldn't pass the bill. Secondly, if we keep the pilots and reduce the taxes so everybody has a fair tax rate, in other words, you know, it only takes $330 million to reduce the Baltimore City property tax by $1, making it no more than Baltimore County, just $330 million, not that much. So instead of giving some folk tax breaks, let's give everybody a lower tax and give no breaks like the other jurisdictions around us. So those are my two things I think we ought to be doing differently about the pilots, with the pilots.
I'm so glad you mentioned the development that's going on in the 7th District, and that where the development project is located. It's also very close to Councilwoman Clark's district,
right,
as well as Councilman Stokes' district.
Right.
We are working with the Mayor's Office of Employment Development to make sure that when these jobs open up, that people are job ready, that they are trained for the job, so that when the interviews come, they will be able to successfully get through that interview process, so that we can have real candidates for these jobs. But also to talk about hiring people in Baltimore City, we have to make sure, again, that people are job ready.
Sure.
Even if you said on the Mark Steiner show that you're willing to hire two young people in Baltimore City, you want two young people that are going to show up on time. You want two young people that are going to act accordingly. You want two young people that are going to add value to what you're doing. And so we have to make sure that we are training our citizens to be employable, which is important. Things like, if you're not going to come in, you have to call out to an employer. Many people treat jobs like they treat school. You know, they get up and they don't feel like going, and they just don't show up. And that's not the way that you keep a job. So we have to make sure that our young people are employable, that all of our citizens are employable. And that takes training. So we have to make sure the Mayor's Office of Employment Development does work with people to make sure that they are job ready.
And I think, but there's job ready and there's job ready. One of the things that Joe Jones's program does is just that.
Yes, absolutely.
You go to his sessions, you see people walk out of there prepared to know how to work.
Got all the tools they need.
410-319-8888. Right to the phone chair. People are waiting to get on this conversation. Edward on the east side, then we'll go to David in Mount Washington. Edward, you're on the air. Hi, Edward, you're there. Edward, you're on the – Edward? Up, down, not there. All right. Let's go to David in Mount Washington. You're on the air.
Hello. How's everybody doing?
Hi, David. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, David.
Hey. Yeah, I guess, you know, I definitely agree with what some of you are saying. We have programs in the city like Center for Urban Families. You got the Mayor's Office for Development. I heard you mention that up in Mondawmin.
Absolutely.
I think they're doing a great job. I think the problem is that when we have these development deals that are brokered, the communities are left out of these deals. I mean, you go into the work site and you see people from, you know, God knows where working, but where are the people in the community who live right there, one, two, three, four blocks away, who are perfectly capable of working and don't have jobs? How come they're not on these work sites? I mean, and then we have to point the finger at who? At the leadership of the city who's brokering these deals and leaving us out of the deals. They get something out of it, but the community doesn't. You know, you have people like my delegate, Jill Carter. I mean, she's the type of person who's going to fight type of issue. She's not, you know, she's not afraid because she's already got people who don't like her for speaking the truth. So, and this is an ugly truth that no one wants to hear. No one wants to talk about.
Well, let me just, if I may jump in. I had a report when the development was going on at Mondawmin Mall in my district that the workforce that was showing up did not appear to be people who lived in the district or lived in Baltimore City. I immediately worked with General Growth Properties and the mall manager, and within literally like a two-week window, we got a job fair on site, well attended. People showed up looking for a job. There wasn't no laughing, joking, playing, talking loud. People were dressed, and you know, from what I saw, people were dressed as if they came out to look for a job. And that's what I call working together. We can work together to resolve some of these issues, but it is a collaborative effort. Anywhere that I'm made aware of in my district that it's a problem, I'm going to be on it.
Well, what I'm hearing, what you're saying is you got involved after the situation was brought to your attention. I like what Councilman Stokes said about not even passing the bill to approve these people unless this is an integral part of their whole application. And actually, the caller mentioned Delegate Carter. I remember when she was campaigning, that was one of the things she said. When we have these developers coming in here, we need to get commitments from them that, okay, you're going to get these breaks, but we need something a little bit more from you. We need training and education for the same communities that you're going into. And I just haven't seen that going on here at all. These developers they're doing quite a lot here, and it's great. You know, they're making the city look better, but the local community is continuing to decay all around these developers.
As I said, with the Walmart deal, we are working with that. It's not just Walmart. It's also Lowe's and other stores. But we are working now before the shovel even hits the ground to make sure that people that live in that area and in Baltimore City are job ready when those openings come
but
up.
Let me ask this question. I mean, we talk about, you know, that people have to, city residents should have the jobs that are in the city. So, but this works two ways. So does that mean then the Baltimore County can say, well, you know, somebody who lives on Edmondson Avenue is not going to get a job in Social Security Mall, or they're not going to get a job out on Route 40 because they don't live in Baltimore County, or somebody who lives in Baltimore City can't take the light rail to go to Hunt Valley or any business around Hunt Valley or Cockeysville to get work. I mean, so, Carl Stokes, it can be a very dangerous game to play here.
I don't think so, Mark, and I'll tell you why. Because the unemployment rate in Baltimore City is at least twice as much as anyone else. So, no, it's not. It's an aggressive, affirmative going after solving the problem that contributes to the high rate of poverty. We're certainly the most impoverished place around, and so when we're this impoverished, that bleeds out into the surrounding jurisdiction. So it is not exactly the same thing. It's not as if people in Baltimore County are standing around without jobs or unemployed. There's not enough work. That is the fact in Baltimore City. There are too many people who don't have jobs, who are unemployed, who need jobs. And so it's not exactly the same thing. It is a more aggressive approach that needs to happen that in some ways says that first hire preference should be the folks who are living across the street without jobs.
I can't resist. I got to get one of my tongue-in-cheek comments. But, you know, we created a whole bunch of unemployable people with police records from all these illegal arrests. It's true. I mean, we have a lot of people here who just cannot and will not be hired because the slightest thing's on the record, and that's it. Nobody wants to touch them. And this is unique to Baltimore City.
Again, in the 7th District, we have and Mondawmin Mall, we have the Career Development Center. They work specifically with people that have records and working to help them very basic things that we take for granted, like making sure that they have identification, that they're able to get their Social Security card and birth certificate so that they can be employable, helping them with their resumes, connecting them with employers that will look beyond their record and give them an opportunity to be employed. And again, Center for Urban Families, many of the people who showed up for their three-week course had records because they asked. And I was there on Friday when the session started. So, you know, we have to make sure also that people are taking advantages of the resources that are offered. We have a lot of people that say there's nothing available, but yet I know in my office, when someone calls and says they want a job, I want them to have a job. And if you want to be employed, I want you to have a job, and I'll work with you to try and connect you to wherever you need to be. I send people to Mondawmin, and the first thing they say, well, I've been there. I didn't get any help. And it was to the point where I had to go myself to see what was going on. And the truth of the matter was that the people were not going.
Oh, wow.
The help was there, but the people were not taking advantage of it. So we have to try and encourage people to reach out and take advantage of these resources. It's a two-step process.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it looks like we're just about out of time. We have a ton of other people calling in, so maybe we can cancel the other show and you guys can stay another hour. Just kidding.
I'll be late for my community meeting. I didn't realize it was so late.
This is a community meeting.
Hey, okay, you all on the radio, please provide me a pass.
Linda Conaway, thank you so much for coming to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
You can rush out to your community meeting.
All right,
leave this one
so
and go to the
much.
Next one. And Carl Stokes, thanks for being with us once again, as always.
Yeah, quick, I know you're going off, but remember, all these people who are legally arrested do not get their records expunged automatically. You need to
talk
about that.
We are going to talk about that. We have a lot of subjects came up we have to make other shows out of.
We created a whole bunch of topics for you.
James MacArthur, Investigative Voice, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for having me.
And, folks, thank you for calling in and making the show what it is. And y'all are calling in. We can't get the calls because the show's over. We'll do it next time. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Stephanie Mavronis, Richard Good, Felicia Faison, and Daniel Gillespie. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, and get information on all of our guests and what they do, you can visit us on our website at steinershow.org. For public radio to be EAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.